Welcome to Tardi Mechanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Adina Schmidman. Mazel Tov on completing Sefer Yehoshua, 24 Prakim, 28 years, and the conquest and division of the land of Israel. I wish you tremendous hatzlacha on the next stops of your journey through our Sifrei Kodesh, our holy books. Please join us at the Siyum with Mrs. Esti Kimchi on Monday, March 9th at 12 noon Eastern. Sign up at ouwomen.org/Siyum. May the messages of this Sefer continue to impact and inspire and be a source of merit for Am Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael during these trying times. And now for today's Perek.
Welcome to the Torah Tei Mechanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Chanalei Rappaport, and I'm very excited to be learning Sefer Shoftim with you. Today we will be learning Perek Aleph. Sefer Shoftim is written many years after the story begins by Shmuel Hanavi after the destruction of the Mishkan in Shiloh. The nation was in shock and wanted to have some guidance, and so he goes back to discuss how the whole thing happened. The first two prakim, the first two chapters, act as an introduction to the whole Sefer. We ended Sefer Yehoshua with many of the battles that were fought being successful. Yehoshua, the emissary of Hashem, has captured and destroyed most of the strong kings and nations that lived in Eretz Yisrael. However, this was certainly not a done job. There was much more that had to be done. The land still needed to be settled, and the people needed to put down their roots. There were still many idol worshippers inhabiting the land, and they needed to be driven out as well. This was all part of the divine plan. As Hashem said, "If I push everyone out at once, the land will become desolate and the animals will take over. Instead, I will do this slowly, or rather, you will do this. You will do this and take over the land and make it yours. But be very careful," Hashem tells us many, many times. "Don't let them stay, or you will be influenced and trapped by them, and you'll start serving Avodah Zarah too." The story of Shoftim is the story of the chalukah, the allotment of the land, its possession, and the local military difficulties that would arise. It's usually localized stories rather than a national battle, so we don't find a global leader. It's much more connected to individual Shoftim, literally translated as judges. Of course, there are partnerships and confederations, and this tribe works with that tribe and that one with this one, but there is no Moshe, no Yehoshua, and nor is there, like there will be in the future, a Shmuel Hanavi or a David HaMelech. It's hard to know what the community actually looked like at that time. The last pasuk in the Sefer tells us the story. "Bayamim haheim, in those days, ein melech b'Yisrael, there is no king amongst the Jews, ish hayashar be'enav ya'aseh, each man does as is fit in his eyes." It seems to indicate that on one hand, although there were, again, localized leaders on the whole, most people were meant to know what to do on their own and did do so on their own and did what they deemed to be the right thing. There's a double entendre here. They did the right thing, but they did what they wanted. And sometimes they didn't do the right thing. There was no king to lead them. This caused many problems, as we'll see. It often took a while after one of the leaders died to appoint a new one. And in that space and in that time, and sometimes even in the time when there was a leader, people did the wrong thing. And so we'll see a cycle happening over and over and over again. The Jews sin, they get punished, they cry out. Hashem sends a shofet, a leader. The leader rules and there's peace. And then the leader dies and the Jews start to sin again. And then there's punishment. And over and over and over again. The shofet did have some similarities to a king. He ruled, he could punish, but he wasn't anointed. He couldn't pass it down to his children. He didn't have the same halachas, the same rules, the same laws as a king, which were not to have too much money, not to have too many wives, because there's no issue here of Yerum Levavo, which is why the king can't have this. He knew, the shofet knew, it's a temporary post. But the temporary, as we said, led to a lot of issues. It's interesting and very important to keep in mind that this Sefer, which seems to be just a cycle of difficulties, has another title, which is Sefer HaYashar, which means the book of the the strait of the righteous, because although there were many problems, on the whole, the Jews did do what they were meant to do and lived a life of Kedusha. We'll see this, that at times there are decades, 40 years, the number 40 years appears often. One even lasted a double 40, 80 years. And it says, Vatishko ta'aretz arba'im shana. The land was silent, was quiet for 40 years. The land was quiet. And we don't know anything that happened during that time of the quiet for 40 years. We hear the trouble, we hear the problems, we hear what precipitated. But we don't hear what happened when things were peaceful. We just know there was peace in the land. Which means that for whatever amount of time it says, the Jews behaved as they should. There were no issues or wars. When we think back on our last few years, we can only be awed by the words we will read many times in our journey over again, Vatishko ta'aretz, and the land was quiet. Our Perek Aleph, begins with Vayihi acharei Mos Yehoshua, and it was after Yehoshua died, which is of course reminiscent of how Yehoshua begins, Vayihi acharei Mos Moshe Eved Hashem, and it was after Moshe died. And it reminds us of this transition, the transition that we're going to be going into now. And it's going to start, the Sefer starts with some specific wars that were fought and others that were not. We can imagine that there's a bit of an existential crisis here. Will Hashem be with us? We're in a new era. What should we expect? They asked the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim were a inside the Choshen that the Kohen Gadol wore, and it was a way of communicating with HaKadosh Baruch Hu by lighting up the stones of the Choshen, the breastplate that the high priest wore, and it was used as a vehicle to ask the questions. And they asked the Urim V'Tumim, who should be first, meaning which Shevet should go back to war first? And of course, the answer is Yehuda, who's always the tribe of the king. Of course you should lead. And we'll see the true leadership and what he does and how he does it. He includes the tribe of Shimon, and he asks for help. In Pasuk Gimel, in verse 3, Vayomer Yehuda l'Shimon Achiv. And Yehuda says to Shimon, his brother, please come with me, and we're going to fight the Knani. And then, V'halachti gamani itcha b'garelecha. And then I'll go with you. Meaning he's saying, I need your help, and I'll help you. Creating brothership. Vayelech itay Shimon. And Shimon goes with him, and they win this one against a cruel king whose name was Adoni Bezek, and they cut off his toes, his thumb, and the thumb of his foot, the thumb of his hand and the thumb of his foot. Adoni Bezek acknowledges in Pasuk Zayin in verse 7, Vayomer Adoni Bezek, Shivim Malachim, there were 70 kings, Bahonos Yedeim V'Raglehem, the thumbs of their fingers and of their toes, mekutzatzim hayu melaktim tachas shulchani, were under my table gathering food, kasher asisi, like I did, kain shilam li elakim, so Hashem paid me back. I was so powerful that I had these 70 kings licking under my table. And the reason that we know this is, the reason that we're told this is that we can see his great power and to recognize how amazing it was that they were able to capture him. Then we have a couple of stories that are repeated from Sefer Yehoshua. It starts with Kalev capturing Hebron, and Hebron had giants there. This is a story that was promised to Kalev, a place that was promised to Kalev years ago. And then another very cryptic story about a place called Dvir. And the Pasuk tells us that Dvir used to be called Kiryat Sefer. And we could understand the story on a pshat level, technically. We could just understand the literal translation. But our chazal, our rabbis, give us a deeper meaning of the story with a message of the supremacy of Torah that is part of the message that Shmuel is trying to impart to them. In Pasuk Yud Beis, in verse 12, Kalev makes a declaration, and he promises, Vayomer Kalev, Asher Yakez Kiryat Sefer, whoever is going to destroy the city of Kiryat Sefer, Ulechada, and captures it, V'nasati Lei as Achsa Biti Leisha. I'm going to give them Achsa, my daughter, as a wife. The Mefarshim say that Achsa is called Achsa from the same letters as the word Ka'as, which means anger, which means that she made everybody angry because she was so beautiful, and everyone looked at her and said, how come she could be so beautiful? How does she get her beauty? Chazal say this can't be just talking about a physical war, but a spiritual one as well, because the whole story is strange. Surely Kalev, who has managed to capture Hebron and its giants, can capture this city as well. Also, are we a military nation? Meaning, like, give your daughter to the gallant knight? What if the person was not deserving? And also, Kalev says, whoever destroys Kiryat Sefer. Now, the Pasuk before has given us a detail which seems to us to be an obscure detail, but that the city is called Dvir, but it used to be called Kiryat Sefer. So why would Kalev call it Kiryat Sefer? Kalev should have called it Dvir. So there must be something else going on here. There's a Gemara in Ta'anis that discusses that sometimes people make up conditions that have the potential to end up badly. For example, when Eliezer goes to find a wife for Yitzchak, he makes a condition that the girl who gives the camels to drink would end up being Yitzchak's wife. And this could have ended up totally wrong, with the girl being very, very inappropriate. Not advisable way to find a shidduch for your son. In the list of people that make up these conditions, Kalev is not mentioned at all, although we can also imagine that this would be a condition that might end up badly, like he could end up with a strong warrior, but an uneducated boor who would be unworthy of being his son-in-law. Rashi there says that no, this could not have ended up badly because we're not talking about a physical fight here, and therefore the person could not have been inappropriate. So what was this fight? Now, perhaps it was also a physical fight, but what we learn from here is that when there was the death of Moshe, when Moshe died, everybody was in deep, dark mourning. And through that mourning, a lot was forgotten. A lot of the things that Moshe had taught them were forgotten. It gives us a number, 1,700 different things that were lost. And it tells us that this is what Kalev wanted to find. And therefore he calls it Kiryat Sefer. Find me the Sefer, find me the book, find me these halachos that were lost. And the person who is able to retrieve it through his chachma, through his pilpul, through his Torah, was a man whose name was Asniel ben Kenaz. Vayil Keda, Asniel ben Kenaz, Achi Kalev HaKatan. The younger brother, his younger brother, was actually Kalev's younger brother, who was able to retrieve the halachas and, again, according to Pshat, according to the literal meaning, capture the city. Vayitin lai es achsa bitay leisha. And he gives him, his brother, Achsa, his daughter, as a wife. He marries her, and then she asks him, she says, I want to ask my father for a better piece of land. She says to her father, you gave me this Kiryat Sefer, but it's in the Negev. It's all dry. It's dry land. According to Rashi, what she was saying is, this man that I married, it's all dry. There's no physical pleasure here. There's just Torah here. And her father tells her and tells us, no, my daughter. I didn't give you dry land. I gave you gulais ilit ve'es gulait tachtiz. I gave you, yes, the wellsprings of above and also wellsprings from below. And what he was telling her, and again telling us, is that the true pleasure, not just the pleasure that's going to be up there, but the pleasure down here, yes, you will benefit up there, but also you'll benefit down here too by marrying a learned man, by marrying a good man, by marrying a Torah scholar. You benefit down here too. There is no better land. And to validate this, we see in Pasuk Tesayin in verse 15, that Uvnei Keni Chosen Moshe Alume Ir Hatmarim Es Bnei Yehuda Midbar Yehuda Asher B'Negev Arad. We have a family who is the children of Keni, who is the father-in-law of Moshe, so we're talking about Yisro, who had inherited a piece of land near Yericho called Ir Hatmarim. They moved from the Yericho area to Bnei Yehuda, who were in the Midbar Yehuda, that was in the Negev Arad, and they went and they lived there. Why did they go to live there? Why did they leave a beautiful city in order to live in the desert? Because they wanted to be closer, spiritually closer. And spiritual closeness was worth more for them than living in Ir Hatmarim. The parak continues with Yehuda continuing to be victorious because, as the pasuk says, "Vayihi Hashem es Yehuda," that Hashem was with Yehuda, although he was not fully victorious. The pasuk tells us about some of the valley people who had rechav barzel; they had chariots made out of iron, and they were not able to conquer them. Although it seems like with enough determination, they could have conquered them. Which leads us to the depressing end of this parak, which is a whole list of places that they did not conquer, which is going to be the source of so much trouble moving forward. Menasha did not possess Beishan and its town. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron and Nahalol. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh. And therefore the Canaanim, with their mindset, their polytheistic worldview of the shallow serving of gods, which was immoral, often cruel, and impossible to reconcile with the service of Hashem, which the Jews had been warned against multiple times before coming into Eretz Yisrael, and yet they did not do what they were supposed to do. They allowed the nations to continue to live there, a religious and moral thorn in the side of the Jews, who didn't recognize the threat that they posed. As long as the Canaanite worldview had not been rejected, although Yehoshua may have long ago vanquished their armies on the battlefield, they will continue to represent a real existential threat to the Jewish nation. Again, this is all written by Shmuel. Many years later, he's trying to consolidate the nation and bring it back to a level. And he will highlight the negative, all the places they didn't capture, to get them to realize the great harm caused by the mistakes made before so that they should correct them. This is the journey we have embarked on today. The study of Sefer Shoftim, the mistakes, the mission, the individuals who tried to fight the tide, the failures and victories of the young Jewish nation in their land. Thank you for learning together in memory of our dear grandmothers, Miriam Schenker, Rachel Friedman, Teresa Schreiber, and Bella Oppenheimer, Alayim HaShalom, Neshot Chayil, who lived with the utmost commitment to Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasodim, despite the physical and spiritual challenges they faced living in the United States, Israel, or Europe. May their example continue to inspire our families and the family of Klal Yisrael. Nina and Chaim Schenker.